Good morning and welcome to Wanda Speaks, a Black Arts and Culture Program of African Sisters Media Network. We are having a special broadcast today, October 21st, the 7-month anniversary of the killing of Alex Alejandro Neto in Bernal Heights Park, in Bernal Heights area in San Francisco. He was killed by the San Francisco police on March 21st. And he is being honored in an altar installation as a part of the current Dia de los Muertos at SOMARTS. It's the 15th annual Dia de los Muertos at SOMARTS. And this particular year, the theme is Visions at Twilight. And I had a conversation with Adriana Camarena, who, along with others, created this altar honoring Alejandro's life. And so we're going to talk about that in this wonderful interview that I'm going to share with you. But the reason why we're broadcasting today is because there is a special commemorative event today in Bernal Heights, and I suggest that people go to the website, justice4alexneto.org, to find out about that. But also, Adriana is going to tell you about it in our conversation. I'm going to play a little music sort of introduce the piece, and I wanted to also let people know that tomorrow is October 22nd, and it's the day that we remember those that have lost their lives due to police violence. The Stolen Legacy Project is part of the October 22nd movement, and in Oakland, there is going to be a rally in Oscar Grant Plaza, also known as the City Hall Plaza, 14th and Broadway, and in San Francisco, there are going to be some events, and all throughout the country, there are events commemorating and honoring those people who lost their lives to violence, specifically police violence, violence by the state. And so you can go to the October 22nd movement to find out sort of what's going on in your neighborhood. So I am going to play... the creator has a master plan with the Bryant Bowling, I'm not sure if it's a quartet or quintet, featuring Leon Thomas. Actually, I'm not sure if Brian is in this, but anyway, the creator has a master plan.
Place where love will always shine. shadows of love that's so divine. And the glow of that love was like a sky, up above in the sea. Can't you see? Come with me.
Okay, so I'm going to play that interview. I want to make a couple of announcements. The community choir, Remembering Legends in Music and Poetry, is a scholarship fundraiser, and it's October 25th at 5 p.m. on Saturday at the Unity Church of Richmond, 351 28th Street in Richmond, California. Donations are $10. And for tickets, please contact 510-691-7826, 510-691-7826. There are a whole lot of numbers here, but you can just show up. And also this weekend, I want to congratulate Ms. Jacqueline Hairston on her Reverend Thurman Awards, a convocation award that she received from the Church for the Fellowship of All People, and Howard Thurman Award. And the Friends of the Negro Spirituals is having its annual, well, actually, I don't know if it's annual, but they're having their award ceremony this weekend at the West Oakland Senior Center, which is at 18th and Adeline in West Oakland. And I believe that's early afternoon, like 1-ish. But you can call the venue, or you could also look up Friends of the Negro Spirituals online and find out what time that annual event is. It's going to be really wonderful, and they're honoring the Church for the Fellowship of All People, Dr. Howard Thurman's Church, this weekend, as well as others. It's a really, really wonderful, wonderful occasion. So I wanted to let people know about that as well. And if you haven't seen Idris Cooper Anifa Woshe's Travels While Black, it is simply fantastic, and you definitely don't want to miss it. It's at Brava in the Annex through this Sunday, and it's a Friday, Saturday evenings at 8, and Sunday, I believe, at 3 o'clock. And it's really, really wonderful. So my Wanda's Picks is down right now. You can't see my picks for posted them on my blog. WandaSabir.blogspot.com. And also you can read them at the San Francisco Bay View newspaper website. So I am going to play this interview with Adriana. It's just simply fantastic, and she, you know, talks about the altar that's up presently as a part of the Soul Marts Dia de los Muertos annual 15th annual exhibition, and there are some special events happening. So stay tuned. Thanks for joining us. Peace and blessings.
So, Adriana, why don't you tell us about the installation that you are? It's like a collaborative project, right? I mean, there's more than one person involved in this altar that you have erected.
Yeah. Hi, Wanda. Thanks for having me on your show. My name is Adriana Camarena, and I'm participating in the SOMART's annual exhibit for Day of the Dead. And this is an invitation for artists to set up altars to honor beloved dead. And I participated in the show with the parents of Alex Nieto, Refugio, and Elvira Nieto, as well as filmmaker Yvonne Iriondo, and Maria Villalta, which is a person who works on the justice cause for Alex Nieto, and Paz de la Calzada, a sculptural and visual artist. So together, we created an installation altar, an altar for Alex Nieto. Alex Nieto was a young man, 28 years old, who was killed by San Francisco Police Department officers on March 21st, 2014, that is this year. He was killed on Vernal Heights. He was a young man who was very much part of his community in the Mission in Vernal Heights. He had lived there all his life. He was studying, and he had just finished his credits for his degree in administration of justice at City College. And he was always participating in electoral campaigns and community events, whether they were cultural or political. He was very much interested in social justice issues as well. He was also a nighttime security guard. That's how he earned his living. And on that Friday evening, was sunset at Vernal. And he often went to Vernal, whether it was to exercise or walk his dog, or like he was doing that day, eating a meal before going off to work. And so Alex was sitting near a bench, or standing near a bench, eating his burrito, when a dog walker passed by and simply didn't like how Alex looked. And so he continued down the hill, and from looking at Alejandro, called 911. And he described Alejandro as a tall Latino male wearing a red jacket with a gun at his hip. Now, as I was mentioning, Alex was a nighttime security guard, and he was dressed for work. He had his taser at his hip, his licensed taser that was part of his work uniform. But instead of inquiring with Alex, or just, you know, like a neighbor would do, just say, hey, because Alex wasn't bothering anyone. There are no reports of Alejandro being aggressive or in some way pretending a threat to anyone. This person just didn't like who Alejandro looked like. So the police responded to this call. The call came in around 7:11 p.m. It's still light out. It's the twilight. And the show at SOMARTS is precisely called Visions at Twilight, and we've called our installation The Twilight of Alex Nieto. So in this installation, we're representing the death of Alex and what has meant to his family and his community. But what happened is that the police came responding to this call. At 7:14, the caller was still on the line, and he described Alex as eating sunflower seeds or chips. So again, Alex is not doing anything threatening. He's just eating a meal. But nevertheless, when the police arrived, by 7:18, the shots are heard by the same caller who stayed on the line. Mm-hmm. So the police found him, and now eyewitnesses and ear witnesses report that they confronted him, just yelled out, you know, jumped out of patrol cars from 75 feet away because he had already started walking down the hill when they found him, and yelled stop and immediately shot him twice or three times. It's unclear. There's an audio recording of the two. And then there was a successive volley of shots, at least 10 shots. Now the autopsy shows that Alex has a few 15 bullet wounds. So I work very closely on the SOMARTS installation with Elisa Nieto, Alex's mom, because what we are trying to represent in the altar is the process of loss for family. While still making an altar for Alex, so when you come into the altar, you'll see a story of who Alex was, but you'll also see his security guard uniform. He was, you know, a courageous young man. And then we had a Giants T-shirt of his on the wall too, although unfortunately got stolen at the Giants Fever.
Oh, are you serious? You mean that it was stolen from the altar?
From the altar, yeah.
Wow. Oh, I've never heard of anyone losing items in an art. You know, wow. Huh.
Usually, you lose the things like. Like if you leave a bottle of liquor for your loved
mm-hmm.
ones.
So yeah, for libations or something. Uh-huh.
Yeah, the libations tend to disappear. But, you know, yes, we were upset about it, but most of all because we just want people to respect the altar. In any
mm-hmm.
case,
yeah.
If anybody wants to donate a shirt to replace that one, would be happy to put it up.
Interesting.
But anyways, and the altar represents the living room, the Nieto's living room, mm-hmm. and there's also a framed picture of the family when Alex and his brother were really young. Alex was probably, I don't know, 8. And so that we call that window into the past when
mm-hmm.
the family was complete.
Mm-hmm.
And we've also, there's an altar, permanent altar on Bernal Hill that we maintain at the site where Alex was killed. And we represent that altar from the hill in this installation also with a mound, which also has rocks from Bernal Heights, and a representation of the same type of cross that Alex's father always put up on the hill. And he made one for our installation too.
Mm-hmm.
And then with the help of Yvonne Iriondo, we created a video, which is more of an impressionistic video with comments of the parents of their impressions of Alex when living, and also their thoughts about after his passing, making reference to the hawk that's always on the hill, and they look at the hawk and often wonder, you know, is that the spirit of Alex trying to tell them something? So together, this altar, and there's also an explanation of what the police say happened, and what we think, and also the lawsuit that the family has now established against the city and SFPD says, because the police say that, of course, they have to create a credible threat, as they always do, and so they created a version in which Alex raises his taser, which is pretty much impossible to believe by any of his family and friends, especially considering that Alex was also interning at the probation department, and, you know, his whole career was working within the general confines of law enforcement. He was a security guard. He was a very calm person. So it's just an impossible version of events. And now with the autopsy, it's very clear that the majority of the shots, 11 of those, possible 15 bullet wounds are caused by downward trajectory shots, and the only upward trajectory shots of, you know, police finding Alex from downhill from him, therefore the only upward trajectory shots are to his leg and his hand. And so it seemed to be that Alex was raising his hands or, doing nothing but just being an up, you know, I can't even explain it, you know, but
he was cooperating.
He was just being peaceful, and he was probably even surprised.
I'm sure he was surprised.
But he probably didn't even know that all those sirens were for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, particularly because I'm looking, at some images of the installation, and you know, you have a security jacket, vest. And shirt, you know, it's a white shirt. It says security on his sleeve, and then on the vest it says security. It's written on there. So I'm thinking they can see. It says security. I mean, he looks like he's in a uniform. So I don't understand.
Was wearing his red jacket at that.
Oh, you mean it was covering the security vest, or
like,
they couldn't see that part.
No, he was wearing his red jacket, and obviously what the police did is that they profiled him as a gangbanger. That's the reference to the red shirt that they bring up and that the collar brought up. But he was then wearing baggy pants, he was wearing his security pants, and again, police cannot shoot a person just randomly.
Yeah.
It has to be a specific, verifiable threat.
Mm-hmm.
And what they did, as they do with many other minorities, in the U.S., is that they criminally profiled him, which is illegal, as somebody dangerous, even though he wasn't doing anything dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
That's the issue at hand.
Yeah, and also in the installation, you have photographs of Alejandro, you know, graduating. Is it from the academy or from high school or from college? What's the photograph of him in his graduation regalia?
I believe that's from his high school.
Okay.
And then there's another certificate on the other wall that you see is that his mom received, just for Mother's Day, his degree from City College.
Okay.
So he wasn't able to be at his City College graduation, but he graduated. Which, as you know, for young men and women who are in low-income communities, to be that determined that you were going to go through the City College program, and he wanted to transfer into a four-year college program after that.
Wow, so he was killed before graduation.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really...
In March 21st. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Wow, it's really tragic. And I was just looking at just the kind of work, you know, that you do, you know, as an artist. It seems that a lot of your work is almost like documentation before a population disappears. You know, your 108 homes, you know, your various mission pieces, the various photo essays that you have. Can you talk about you know, sort of your visual aesthetic in your art?
I should say that I'm actually primarily a writer, and that's some of the work that you just mentioned, like the essay on 108 homes and other essays that I've written. I started out writing about the Mission District. I wasn't attempting to write about a neighborhood that's disappearing, but it just so happened that that's what's happening to the Mission. I was more interested in just documenting the everyday lives of people in the neighborhood. And people with whom I had maybe some cultural distance, whether it was homies standing on a corner or day laborers standing on another corner, you know, geographically placed in the Mission, waiting for work. And so those were my initial essays. And as I got to know more people in the Mission, I started seeing that there are a variety of hardships that people go through. I've also written about mothers who have lost children to street violence, and that's another series of essays. But I also started writing about the loss of home, and I collaborated the first installation on this topic that I did. I worked with Yolanda Lopez, who is a Chicana art legend, among the first women recognized as a Chicana artist in the U.S., and she is from the mission, and her work is important. And she is being evicted from her home of 35 years, alongside with her former partner, René Yáñez, who's also a very well-known artist and art curator in the mission, and his partner, Cynthia Wallace, and their common son, Rio Yáñez. And it is René Yáñez and Rio Yáñez who are
curating.
So much.
Mm-hmm.
So the aesthetic was to, you know, in some ways help people understand how heavy the legal processes are that can invade a person's home. And so with Yolanda, she wanted to work with her eviction papers, which we blew up, you know, the papers and put them on a wall and created a narrative around a murder board. And it's really funny that we're talking about this right now, because it was while that exhibit for Solo Mujeres was up at the Mission Cultural Center that Alex Nieto died. And so for me, those pieces are actually connected, the altar and Yolanda's piece, because also Yolanda worked on a case around a very famous case in the mission of seven Latino young men, the Los Siete de la Raza, who were being accused of having killed a police, when it turns out that actually it was the police who were harassing them, and eventually one officer shot the other officer in trying to shoot the young men. So they were eventually acquitted, but Yolanda was part of this. You know, it's been decades of police abuse in the mission, and Mission and Bernal Heights are part of the same zip code, and young people who live in Bernal were always in the mission, just like Alex. So when we talk about mission, we also talk about the broader cultural reach of the mission.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of the visual work that I do. I also take photos of home objects that are strewn on the street as a way of just like thinking about how of homelessness and loss of home. So that's another part of the visual work that I do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, you title on your website, unsettlers.org, you've got home and eviction, you've got mothers and sorrows, war and migrations, and then you have unsettlers. And what I was really, I really love the piece, Matres Dolorosas?
Matres Dolorosas.
Yeah, A Watershed of Tears, excerpt. You know, that's really beautiful. Could you tell us about, you know, the, I mean, it's a written piece, but it also has a visual component. I just wonder if you could tell us about that, that piece, and it's actually centered in the actual there's a place, because most of your pieces they're writing, but then there's also a physical place you can go to. And before you answer that, I was wondering, was the bench installed at the place where Alejandra was killed? Is that there now?
The benches were already there.
Oh, okay.
They're just park benches.
Okay.
And so we are trying to advocate for a commemorative bench to be placed for Alex at the site where he was killed.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a long process with Parks and Recs, and it requires a fundraising also for about $5,000 or something like that.
Oh, my.
But so far what we've been able to do, even through vandalism at times, is to maintain an altar parallel to the site where he was killed.
Mm-hmm.
On the north side slope of Bernal.
Okay.
If you're on Bernal, you'll see it and you'll understand what it's about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So your piece, pronounce it again for me.
Matres Dolorosas, and it's what I refer to in that piece is the mission. It has a nickname. The mission of San Francisco de Assis. It was how the mission here in San Francisco was originally named, but it ran next to an Arroyo de los Dolores, the Creek of Sorrows.
Mm.
And it's because of the date when the mission was founded that creek got its name. the Creek of Sorrows, which is when Catholics venerate the Our Mother of Sorrows, which is the Latin title of Matres Dolorosas, no?
Mm-hmm.
And so, Mater Dolorosa, in fact. But what it commemorates are the seven sorrows of Mary, the Mother of Christ. And so what I was trying to do in that piece is to mention the actual river that actually still flows through the missions, but is underground,
mm-hmm.
through subterranean channels, passing right by Mission High, down 18th. Well, there are different venues, there are different creeks, but the rivers of the mission are still there. And so I was trying to mention how a lot of the sorrows are unseen. They're there, they're coursing, and, you know, a torrential sweep of grief, and a lot of it is unseen, particularly because we're in a poor neighborhood, and in poor neighborhoods, many of these stories go by unseen or misunderstood. Or now with gentrification, it's not the stories told. It's not the stories that gain attention. But they're still there, like those rivers. And so I tell stories of mothers who have suffered loss, whether it's, for example, the policing of their children, or losing children through addiction, or through street violence, and other sorrows that even eviction also, that mothers may face. And it's in this, because I had been interacting already with mothers from the mission, including Maddie Scott and Liz Torres, which are advocates for peace on the streets of San Francisco, because they both have lost children to gun violence. I had already been understanding what it is to lose a child. I don't have children myself, but I'm very interested in the stories of mothers and their relationship to children. And so when I heard of Alex, and I knew Alex, he was an acquaintance, and I knew a little bit better his friend Ben Baxierra. And so through Ben, who also is a mission writer, I came into contact with the Nieto family very soon after his death in March. And since then, I've been collaborating very closely with them, trying to accompany them through this struggle. And so you could say that my artwork is very much intertwined with my social justice work. My thinking is also whether I'm just writing a piece or presenting a piece. But, you know, ultimately, it's for the author at Somars, it's very much a collaborative piece, primarily with Elvira Nieto, who, you know, painted the walls, set up the decoration, chose her son's baseball caps and clothing that to commemorate him, and the pictures that she wanted to put up. And she's so proud of him that he got his City College degree, and, you know, she's very proud of the effort that her son had made through his life, and she just wanted to honor him that way.
Mm-hmm.
So that was also the intent of portraying in a visual way some of those stories or some of those feelings that are honored in Matres Dolorosas, also in a visual way, and also just through such close proximity with the story with Alex Nieto and his parents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you think about the Creek of Sorrows, which flows beneath the ground, it's not visible anymore, as a metaphor for the place that is the mission. What do you think about that? That underlying all of this, there is, you know, these tears flowing beneath the asphalt, you know, and, you know, it's unseen, but it is, it seems to be resonating presently within the communities that live in this area where the creek is flowing. And
right.
and then you know, you look at other work of yours, My Mission Blood, Tales from the Block, and again, you know, you're documenting periods that might not be here and are actually disappearing. So, you know, your photographs of, you know, the community, it's almost like creating this album so that you can look back and say, oh yeah, I was there.
And you know what? Yes, I'm trying to bring the invisible forward.
Mm-mm.
And it's invisible not because people don't see it. People in the mission know these stories quite closely, quite personally.
Mm-hmm.
They're integrated into their identity of who they are as low-income folk, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so part of what happens now with gentrification in the mission, when these populations in a very accelerated way are being pushed out or simply just cannot come back. You know, maybe went out, had a job, and said, I want to come back to the neighborhood, and now simply it's unaffordable, can't come back, is that I just want to bring to light that, you know, that these, that we are the ones who don't see the stories. Those of us who have not experienced these type of suffering, we are the ones who need to make the effort to connect. And so a lot of my work is, as I said, to accompany and become aware, become conscious of the stories that I may fail to see because I didn't experience them. But what I like with my mission Blood, that's a collaborative project, because I have found that the generational Latinos of the mission, people who grew up here, you know, who lived here in the last 30, 40, 50 years, they're actually quite vocal and, you know, they stand up for themselves. And the mission has a huge history of social justice movements, so they're very proud. And so instead of, like, trying to tell their story, I want them to have them tell their own story.
Mm-hmm.
So with my mission Blood, what I'm trying to ask is if you're from the mission and you grew up in the mission in the last 50 years, which is kind of like the peak Latino population, could you please send us, and this is a collaboration I have with Antoinette Rios and Oscar Salinas, please send us your home photos of your block, and then we'll stage storytelling circles where you can tell us a story related to your photos.
Mm-hmm.
Because also with those photos, that photo album, I'm trying to recover a lost landscape, a landscape that's no longer there because now the streets now look different, the shops have changed, et cetera, no? So I'm really trying to honor that generation, which is still alive. I feel very often insulted because their neighborhood where they were safe, where they were acknowledged, where they knew everybody walking down the block, suddenly now they're seen as strangers, which, again, is part of what happened with Alex Nieto. A young man who would have been safe maybe 10 years back in his neighborhood, just, you know, dressed as a security guard going off to work, is now seen as dangerous because there's a new population moving in that doesn't understand the stories of a working class neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I want to read your bio, and then I want you to talk some more about place and personhood and what happens to the person when the place disappears, goes underground, or they're moved away to another place, you know, sort of how does one sort of regroup when home is no longer, you know, where it used to be. You are a Mexican from Mexico, you're right, complicated by an upbringing in the U.S., Uruguay, and Mexico. You became a resident of the Mission District of San Francisco in 2008, and since arriving in the Mission, you began collecting tales of borders, line crossings, and overlapping identities told by residents to provide a layered picture of this traditionally working-class immigrant neighborhood in California. Are there any parallels of the Mission District in other places that you've lived?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think all around the world, these global cities, the big cities, are experiencing a shifting trend. It used to be that the inner cities were poor and that the suburbia was where the middle class or upper middle class or the rich wanted to live. And now you can see it in most places, whether it's New York on the other coast or London, or in my case, I know about Mexico City. And living in Mexico City, you could say I was part of a gentrification of my own neighborhood, because my grandmother lived in the, and my grandmother and my mother and all her siblings grew up in La Condesa, which was, you know, a middle to low middle class neighborhood in Mexico City, working class folk also. And it just became, in the last 2 decades, an extremely popular place to live in. And so you suddenly had all these professionals coming to live in the neighborhood. And it just so happened that, you know, when I was working in Mexico, I was one of those professionals that came back to my grandmother's neighborhood. And so I now look back and say I was part of gentrifying the neighborhood, with, whether I understood it or not, even though you could say it was my own neighborhood. And so now that I'm back in the mission, I recognize the same issues. It's become popular to move back into the inner city. And this means pushing out folk to the suburbs, far away and very inconvenient transit. And I tell a little bit of this story in an essay I wrote called Street Food, that was published by N+1 magazine in 2012, I believe. But it's still relevant to today, because it's already when you saw the heightened, the real estate speculation in the city that was raising prices around the tech shuttle bus stops, 6%, 12%, you know, 12% premiums on homes around these stops. And it's, again, you have to start thinking about who is actually behind the rebranding of places, and it's the real estate speculators, right?
Mm-hmm.
But also I wanted to say, I know we've been talking about loss, but what you discover in getting close to these stories of loss is actually the stories of resilience. I mean, while we have an altar for Alex, just imagine the type of resilience it takes for Elvira Nieto to work on this altar, want to honor her son and also Refugio, and work with other artists and other activists who want to help them, and just push forward in trying to commemorate the positive sides of, you know, the positive story of their son, because the police always want to murder, you know, the victim's character. So it's the same with the stories of the mission. Whether I'm talking to people from My Mission Blood, they all have huge stories of, you know, coming back, you know, from sometimes very low points of homelessness and alcoholism, and then coming back, you know, with huge effort and huge survival skills, no?
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing happens in telling different stories. So in the end, what I'm really trying to show is that low-income communities suffer disproportionately these type of violences. And so these violences are violences of poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And the true issue at hand is to think about why this happens in low-income communities. How is this related to whether you have property or don't have property, or you can have enough money to confront an unjust legal system? Those are the questions that are actually kind of underneath the stories that I tell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's your training? You've lived in some very different places. Mexico City, you just mentioned, where your grandmother is, and Uruguay, and then now the U.S. Could you talk about your own sort of preparation for what you're doing presently, you know, that, you know, sort of comes into place with regards to, you know, this altar that you were a part of erecting for the Dia de los Muertos, the annual commemoration of our ancestors at SOMARTS. I believe this is the 15th annual Dia de los Muertos.
Yeah. Right. So, my own preparation, you know, I come from a family of artists and farmers. And
okay.
On my dad's side, they were farmers, and my mom's side, they were artists. It's my grandfather was a cinematographer, my mom's a painter, so is my sister, and my brother-in-law, another sister, is a baker and photographer. But anyways, on my dad's side, you know, he was he came from a farming community and he became a professional, right? And so as happens to many of us who are encouraged by parents who made it out of poverty, I also became a professional. I became a lawyer in Mexico. I have a law degree from Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but I've always been more of a writer. And so after many efforts trying to be a professional, and I still have a foot in the legal world. That's my income job, you could say.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a consultant on Mexican law. As many artists do, we have our income jobs. when I came finally to San Francisco to live in the Mission, that's when I broke off to also, in 2007, really begin my craft at writing, at published writing.
Mm-hmm.
And also have, you know, just sometimes whatever the story requires, that's the medium that I use. And in this case, it was an installation. And to be honest, I learned a lot from doing that installation with Yolanda Lopez. I can't tell you how honored I am that one of my first experiences with an installation was with such a legend
mm-hmm.
of Mission and Chicano culture. So I'm incredibly grateful to her for mentoring.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So your legal background in Mexican law, I presume you said Mexican law, which means you're not practicing law here. You don't have a license to practice in California or in the United States. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I was just thinking how great it would be if you could do, you know, the art, and then also because this particular installation is looking at a wrongful death, you know, police killing, that, wow, if you had that hat too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you do have that hat, but you can't necessarily represent the family.
And, you know, at this point, I feel that I law is not exactly, like, the legal practice is not exactly what I'm doing. It's helpful in any case for understanding legal documents and translating legal documents, because any lawyer will tell you, like, laws are, the details are different, but the general aspects of law are common. You understand more or less what it's trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the legal systems are trying to do. And I am, in fact, a consultant on legal reform. That's how I make my income as a consultant on international projects where you might need some advice from somebody who understands, first of all, law, but also legal reform in Latin American countries.
Mm-hmm.
And the Mexican legal system is very much like the legal system in other countries. So I as I said, I keep a foot in the legal world because that's my yearly income. But other than that, you know, it's just like I think I best serve the family, as I said, by being a companion to their process and being their translator of very heavy documents. I sat down with them to read them their own lawsuit. I sat down with them to read them the autopsy report. And, you know, and it helps me because these are really complicated documents for anybody who's not an expert. And I think it's because I have this free time and I am not a free time in terms of like that artistic free time and that the time that activists find to just think about issues, that I am able to translate this into a way that other people may understand it beyond the legal realm. And they have a very good lawyer. Anyways, they're represented by the offices of John Burris and specifically by Adante Pointer.
Mm-hmm.
So legal representation is there, and they often help me understand what's next, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's next in the legal process.
Right. Yeah, you already mentioned that that your essay Street Food is published in Plus One Literary Magazine summer 2012, and then it was later reprinted as an excerpt in the Utney Reader April 2013, and you have another essay in The Geography of the Unseen in Rebecca Solnit's Infinite City, a San Francisco Atlas, UC Press, 2010. And you're working on a literary book project now entitled Unsettlers, Migrants, Homies, and Mamas in the Mission District of San Francisco. How is this project coming along?
Well, since I've taken on the being a community organizer for the Alex Nieto case, it suddenly has put a dent into my my writing time. But I, you know, and whenever I have a chance, I push out an essay like the, you know, the 108 Home,
mm-hmm.
which is you know, the experiences that I continue to have about bumping around in the neighborhood. I have other essays in the work. One of my favorite ones that I haven't yet published, but stay tuned,
mm-hmm.
is about this time of year, around October 12th, that, you know, it's Columbus Day, and then for others it's known as the Day of Indigenous People.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about remembering what the mission is. And I have had interviews with people who are Native American in the mission, and there's a huge Mayan community here in San Francisco, to the extent that, talking about legal systems, that San Francisco has had to create a program for Mayan interpreters. So you have all sorts of Native American people coming back to the mission, even as they were displaced from the mission. And, you know, I had to do these quirky essays of talking to people who are of a variety of tribes and have come to the mission for different reasons. There's also the Friendship House, which is a rehab center for Native Americans in the mission. So I try to always remember that this story of displacement has been going on in the mission for, you know, over 400 years, and trying to think about why it connects to the going on today. And it's usually because we live in a capitalist system, and that was the beginning of colonialism, and now it's capitalism, and we continue to face the consequences that if you do not have title to land and you cannot enforce your belonging to land, whatever sentiments you have of belonging or being here are going to be run over. So that's one of some of the thought that's behind my work.
Mm-hmm.
And that I hope to make it into a book as I collect this variety of essays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be really great, because you know, just the little perusal I've made of some of your writing, it's just really really provocative and wonderful, you know, even without the illustrations. Yeah, very, very well done, and interesting, particularly the topics, you know, the people that you're writing about, the place that you're writing about. These are people and places that one doesn't encounter often in literature.
Mm.
So it's almost as if, you know, your writing is giving voice to, you know, both the living and the dead. You know, you let the ancestors speak through you, through your pen, let's say, so to speak.
And it's very much based on oral history,
mm-hmm.
the written work that I do.
Yeah.
So and through that oral history, what I am trying to do is respect the voice of people as they tell me their stories, or in the sentiment that they tell me their stories, so that, again, we can learn from them. You know, we can learn from people who are often not asked for their stories. And let me tell you, people are incredibly generous with their life narratives and their life history, and they want to also be remembered. And so I think in that way, I enjoy the project, going up to strangers that I find, you know, whether they're homeless or whether they're, you know, bus drivers or whatever it is that they're up to. I'm intrigued about my neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that in this neighborhood, and I really encourage people moving into the neighborhood to remember that we newcomers are the strangers, not the people who are here. We're the strangers. And so I always want people to remember that. I hope that that's part of what my writing does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the theme for this year, Visions at Twilight, Dia de los Muertos 2014, the 15th Annual Day of the Dead exhibit, which opened October 10th and it continues through November 8th, at SOM Arts, and is dedicated to Chata Gutierrez, Maya Angelou, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Holly Schneider, and to those whose lives have been affected by evictions, curated by Renee and Rio Yanez. It's, you know, each time, you know, Renee and his son, you know, sort of start thinking about, well, you know, what they're going to do, you know, for this year for Dia de los Muertos. It's always so topical. I mean, just the idea of twilight and then visions at twilight and then thinking about this particular altar that you are a part of, the installation that you're a part of, you know, sort of it happened around twilight. And then you think about what's going on with the ancestors at twilight. You know, spirits are rising around that time, right?
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's always the tradition around Dia de los Muertos.
Mm-hmm.
And also around other older traditions like Samhain and other ones that you might find in our diverse cultures.
Mm-hmm.
That as we enter the deep of winter, as we're moving towards winter, it's a time when, as they say, the veil between worlds is thin. And we can communicate with our beloved. And so in the case of Mexican culture, that's my culture, it's also a very playful moment. Playful in the sense of, like, remembering, you know, just the funny things, too. You can think of death with a certain kind of familiarity and a certain kind of laughter and invite certain kind of mischief. So that Stolen Giants t-shirt,
mm-hmm.
we had to laugh about it and say, you know, we hope that it, Alex just needed his t-shirt so that, you know, to accompany the Giants to the World Series, and or with a gift to someone.
Mm-hmm.
We're still trying to recover a shirt for the exhibit, but we see it with a certain amount of mischief also that's allowable around Dia de los Muertos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly, certainly. Yeah, and this week, October 22nd, is an opportunity for community to commemorate the Stolen Lives and the Stolen Lives Project, which are people whose lives were taken by law enforcement. And there's going to be a big rally in Oakland on the 22nd, you know, sort of looking at, you know, doing a name, doing a roll call. And then on Friday, October 24th, from 7 to 9:30 at SOM Arts, there's another ticketed program, Gathering the Embers, the Dia de los Muertos tribute show. And it's going to be multidisciplinary performers connecting past and present with an evening of story and performance. Are you participating in that at all? In, you know, any of these stories that you've collected and performances that you've staged around the writing?
I'm not participating in the Gathering the Embers.
Oh.
But you did mention the
Stolen Lives
event of October 22nd.
Yes.
And, you know, as I mentioned, Alex died on March 21st, so his 7th month anniversary is tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to be up at the Hill from 6 to 7. And then on Wednesday, the 22nd, is the National Day Against Police Brutality,
mm-hmm.
called forth by the October 22nd movement. And there's a big event at Oakland, but there's also going to be events in San Francisco,
okay.
a noon rally at City Hall. There's going to be an event at Bayview. There's going to be a rally also by SEIU, 1020, I think. I'm not quite sure which one it is, in front of 17th and Bryant, which is where the police keep their military equipment. And what we're doing as Justice for Alex Nieto supporters with his parents and anybody else who wants to come is that we're going to go to the police commission meeting at 6 p.m. at Balboa High School,
mm-hmm.
At the Green Room. And we're going to be there because on that day, we want to keep on asking the questions that remain unanswered. Like, who are the officers who killed Alex? They have not provided their name.
Mm-hmm.
We want to have the original 911 call to determine what was the threat that police were responding to. A man eating, you know, chips and sunflower seeds. We want to have the police report, and we also want to confront them about the autopsy report. So everybody's welcome to come with us. It's at 6 p.m. at Bubble High School as part of that event. And also just come check out the altar and send us your thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
You can do that at info@justiceforalexnieto.org.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the website is Justice, J-U-S-T-I-C-E, the numeral 4, A-L-E-X, Alex, and then N-I-E-T-O.org. And the upcoming events are in the section called Updates, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, they're in our calendar.
Oh, in the calendar section? Okay.
In the calendar section.
Okay, yes. I looked it up there. It's like, that's not current. Okay, yeah. And here's, 5 p.m. burritos on, the 7th, 5 o'clock to 7:30, the Presida Park Playground. Yeah.
We're changing it for this occasion. We're going to meet straight up at Vernal Heights at 6 p.m.
Okay. Okay, are you gonna change it on in the calendar?
Yeah,
because that's what I'm looking at. Okay, all right.
We're short-handed.
Oh, yeah, always. Well, it's been really wonderful speaking to you, Adriana. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to broadcast this tomorrow and Wednesday, so that people don't miss the commemoration, the 7-month commemoration tomorrow.
Cool.
Yeah, and I'll send you a link to it later on today.
Okay.
So you can send
it
out to folks. No problem. It's been really wonderful speaking to you, and I look forward to getting over to SOMARS to see this, in its physical sense. I mean, I'm looking at photographs of the space, but I actually want to, be able to go into the room and sort of, feel Alex's energy and the family's energy, have an opportunity to sort of be in that and experience the loss. Mm-hmm.
And listen to the parents' voices through the video.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But like I told you, I actually met his mother. I'm not sure if his father was there, but I actually did meet Alex's mother and you when at Brava Theater as a part of the play that was closing that particular day, and I can't remember the name of the play. Do you remember the name of the play?
It was A Love Bomb for My Spirit Child.
Right, exactly, yeah.
By Ariel Brown, who's the husband of Oscar Grant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was, oh my goodness, that was a really traumatic experience, that play.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but, losing a loved one is traumatic. But to be able to recreate that in a stage production, wow, that takes a lot of skill.
Yeah, it was and we appreciated them allowing their presence there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you for your work. I'm really looking forward to reading more of your essays, and certainly love to speak to you at some other time, particularly when your collection comes out.
No kidding. I have to stop organizing, I guess.
No, you just have to fit the writing and publishing into the organizing, because the organizing, I don't think it's going to stop for you.
No, but it is what it is right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Well, you take good care.
Thank you.
All right. Peace and blessings.
Bye.
So we're going to close out this special broadcast with Archie Shepp's Revolution.
My grandmother was born during the time of slavery. That was the time when Black people didn't have saxophones. They didn't have trombones or trumpets. They didn't even have drums. All they had was their bodies. Their bodies. sometimes the jawbones of animals, pots and pans. There's a song she taught me that the slaves used to sing. The people up in Harlem, they're talking they want a change. And down in Philadelphia, they're walking 'cause they want a change. I went to San Francisco, baby. Ooh, looking for the stars. But now I'm down in Baghdad. The war has begun. I told her like this. I said, hey, we are the victims. You know what I'm going to tell my son? That death cloaks the Potomac in a scarlet shawl. And the pillow beneath you is not here. But honey, I want you to take this ex-cannibal's kiss and turn it into a revolution.
Mama Rose, Mama Rose.